Good afternoon, everyone. It is March 16th, the Senate Health Care Committee. I am going to, we have a full agenda. We'll need everyone to be very expedient on this. I just lost my quorum.
Well, we can still, we can go.
No, we don't. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 785. And before I do that, we are carrying over Senate Bill 861. So if you're here for Senate Bill 861, we are not hearing that today. We're carrying it over till Tuesday, next Tuesday. All right. With that, again, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 785. And Oliver, would you please describe the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 785, the bill establishes definitions for food-producing, livestock producer, and medically important antibiotics. The bill requires livestock producers to have a licensed veterinarian to approve the use of medically important antibiotics for food-producing animals when certain criteria are met. The measure requires livestock producers that operate concentrated animal feeding operations to file an annual report of medically important antibiotics provided to the food-producing animals. Specifies contents of report. There are no impacts statements issued, and there is a dash one on the list.
Great. We're going to call up Carmen Cordova, Michael Hansen, and Don Holt. Please begin.
Chair Moyes, Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Dawn Nolte. I'm a doctor specializing in treating infections in children. I have over 15 years of experience in using antibiotics to help children fight infection. I am the Oregon State expert in dealing with infections in children with cancer, with inadequate immune systems, and with cystic fibrosis. I work within the Pediatric Infectious Disease Division at Dornbecker Children's Hospital in Portland, Oregon, and I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 785. I want to share two patient experiences with you about resistant bacteria in children here in Oregon. A pediatrician on the coast calls me asking for help on antibiotics on a four-month-old child with a urine infection. And to our surprise, the bacteria was resistant to all antibiotics that are able to be given by mouth. This otherwise healthy four-month-old had to be transferred to a children's hospital to receive antibiotics into his vein for a simple urine infection because we had no other options. He had to have a procedure, including anesthesia, to place a somewhat permanent IV into his arm to receive his antibiotic. Another case is a baby who was born 6 months early in a pregnancy, usually pregnancy is 9 months, and his mother was very sick. And 4 days into his very young life in the NICU, he becomes sick. And his blood contains a bacteria for which there are only 5 antibiotics in the world to able to treat this. A 17-month-old adolescent boy, about a year or so, was diagnosed with cancer. And during his chemotherapy, he suffered a bacteria in his bloodstream, landing him in our ICU. This bacteria could only be treated by 8 antibiotics in the entire world. And these are children, 4 months, 4 days, and 17 years of age, who have never taken antibiotics in their life prior to their infections. I have many more examples of children suffering resistant infections, and these examples are becoming more frequent over the past several years. And this is due to overuse of antibiotics in our community. The bacteria in a person or an animal makes antibodies become smart, and these bacteria get into our community. Bacteria are shared among families and friends during our normal everyday lives. And that's how these antibiotic-resistant bacteria get into a newborn baby, into a young child, and who have otherwise never taken antibiotic medications. So of interest, antibiotics are really the only drug that, when used in one person or one animal, has a direct effect on another person or another animal. Now, if chemotherapy is given to a person for their cancer, that chemotherapy doesn't affect the cancer of another patient. But if antibiotics are given, that antibiotic will only not only change the bacteria in that one person, but also those bacteria will find their way into another person and endanger that second person's health. So again, antibiotics are really the only drug that when used in one person or animal has a direct effect in the health of another person. So we should restrict antibiotics from being overused in mass prevention or non-medical reasons. And prevention and non-medical use of antibiotics are really done, at least in the medical field, in my medical field, because of anxiety. But antibiotics are not anti-anxiety medications. Antibiotics are for infection, and we need to preserve our antibiotics for our sick. So as a medical professional working to combat infections in children, I need all the help I can get. Our community needs to reduce resistant bacteria, and the removal of antibiotics be given to animals for mass prevention of infection or for non-infectious reasons. This will go a long way towards improving the health and preserving the future of our children. And thank you for this opportunity and this time to support Senate Bill 785, and I'm delighted to answer any questions.
Let's go through the panel, and then we'll open up to questions.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the panel. My name is Michael Hansen. I'm a senior scientist at Consumers Union. There, we're the policy and mobilization arm of Consumer Reports. We believe antibiotic resistance is one of the most important health problems today, and that the use of antibiotics in animal agriculture contributes significantly to the problem, and that animal use must be reduced to reduce the threat of antibiotic disease. The federal government has failed to address this problem in an effective way, so it therefore falls upon Oregon to act. And so for these reasons that I'm going to briefly talk about, we strongly support SB 785 with the minus one, with the dash one amendments, because we believe they will protect the health of both Oregonians and consumers elsewhere. And the two basic points I'd like to make is, first, antibiotic use poses a health threat. A UK study has found that by 2050, unless action is taken, antibiotic-resistant infections will kill more people than cancer. In the U.S., the Center for Disease Control notes that antibiotic resistance costs the U.S. economy up to $55 billion, results in over 2 million illnesses, and leads to 23,000 deaths. Many people are surprised to learn that agriculture rather than human medicine is the primary user of antibiotics, with over 70% of all medically important antibiotics sold in 2011 used in agriculture. In fact, the FDA's own data show that use of medically important antibiotics in animal production is actually rising. Between 2009 and 2015, there was a 26% increase, going from 7.6 million kilograms to 9.7. And these antibiotics are used to promote growth, often to promote growth and prevent disease, often in crowded factory farming conditions, which can help lead, create superbugs that are resistant, that are bacteria resistant to three or more classes of antibiotics, and they can infect people via meat, poultry, and via other sources as well. Consumer Reports, we've tested ground beef, chicken, and ground turkey and found superbugs in every case. And we found that where animals were raised without antibiotics, that is, either no antibiotics, organic, or grass-fed, there was less contamination with superbugs, sometimes significantly more so. These superbugs, when they're found on food, they can not only cause illness, but they can make illnesses much more difficult to use. And so to preserve the effectiveness of antibiotics in human medicine, use in animals to promote growth or prevent disease should be prohibited. My second main point is that FDA action is inadequate and ineffective. The FDA's only taken partial steps. Their main responses are these two guidances, guidance number 209 and 213. They were issued in 2012 and 2013. And what these guidances do is they recommend that the drug companies change their labels on medically important antimicrobial products put in food and water, so that as of January of this year, no growth promotion uses are allowed, and there were regulations that also became effective in January that all medically important antimicrobials used in feed and water would no longer be available over the counter. They would only be available through a veterinarian. The loophole in all this, FDA, is that they're still allowing drugs to be used on healthy animals for disease prevention. They got rid of growth promotion, but they still allow disease prevention. And that's problematic because oftentimes that means you're treating a whole herd or flock in the absence of a disease, often for the whole life of the animal. And we don't think that's correct. And in fact, if you look, the Institute of Medicine did a report, and in 1985, 64% of animal antibiotics were used in disease prevention, 24% for growth promotion, and 12% for disease treatment. So the vast bulk of them, over two-thirds of antibiotics, are for disease prevention, which is use on healthy animals to prevent disease. And we should also point out these guidances came out in 2012 and 2013. And if you look at that data since then, in between, as I said, 26% increase in medically important antibiotic use between 2009 and 2015, between 2014 and 2015, there was a 2% increase, even after these guidances came out. This isn't surprising because of this problem of preventative use. And I should also point out, literally about an hour ago, the GAO released a report saying in part that FDA actions on antimicrobial resistance have been inadequate and suggested more action. So in conclusion, we urge Oregon to step in and act on this critical problem by passing SB 780-85 with the -1 amendments. This bill, if you pass it, it will only allow antibiotics to be used to treat sick animals or to control diseases that are present on a facility or in certain other very limited circumstances. And it also would have data collection, so you'd have some kind of idea of how many antibiotics are being used. So we think passing this bill will be an important benefit to Oregon consumers and communities, and will make important contributions to addressing antibiotic resistance nationally. That's why we support. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to address the Senate Committee on Healthcare today. My name is Carmen Cordova, and I'm a microbiologist and staff scientist in the Food and Agriculture Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. On behalf of NRDC, I'm here to testify in support of SB 785. Antibiotic resistance is an epidemic, and experts agree that our collective use and overuse of antibiotics is a chief driver of the problem. We all have important roles to play in curbing overuse. So here's why that puts a spotlight on livestock and poultry production. The U.S. is among the most intensive users of antibiotics in the livestock sector in the developed world. Among all the antibiotics important to humans that are sold in the U.S., around 70% are sold for use in food animals. The vast majority, around 96% of those antibiotics, are administered in food and water at low doses, and that includes an estimated large fraction that is administered to animals that are not sick. The CDC has stated very simply that using antibiotics in people or animals can create drug resistance. In their latest report on antibiotic resistance threats, the CDC highlighted the 18 antibiotic-resistant bacteria that pose a risk to public health. We surveyed the science and found that 8 of those 18 threats have been found either in farm animals or their facilities or on retail meat products in the U.S. This includes the two traditional food pathogens, Salmonella and Campylobacter. What that points to is the fact that there is an increasingly blurry distinction between hospitals, farms, and communities in regards to the bacteria and the antibiotic resistance found in those environments. It also underlines the importance of SB 785 to combat antibiotic resistance threat to human health. There is widespread consensus on the need for action now because of a large body of science that shows that resistant bacteria from poultry and livestock production can be spread via food, water, soil, air, and workers to nearby communities and the broader community at large. Also, because bacteria can share the resistance traits with others, resistant from the farm can be spread to bacteria away from the farm that readily make people sick. Specifically, antibiotic resistance can spread from farms to communities through fresh meats and vegetables. In the case of vegetables, because of water and fertilizer use. For example, a recent study published by FDA scientists found that in a survey of over 3,000 retail meat samples from 8 states, nearly 30% contained staph. And of those, 10% were resistant to multiple drugs. And a little less than 10% were MRSA. In the study, Oregon had the highest rate of retail samples that were positive for staph and the highest rate of MRSA in retail meat. Several studies have shown that workers can carry antibiotic-resistant bacteria, like E. coli and Staph aureus, that originated on the farm back to their communities, and that poses a risk to communities. One recent study showed that in 3 of the leading broiler-producing states, Georgia, Maryland, and Tennessee, the presence of broiler chicken operations is associated with higher rates of salmonella infection in nearby communities. And those infections were caused by salmonella present that is found in chicken, including salmonella, that were antibiotic resistant. The authors of the study offered 2 explanations. Either workers could have brought salmonella into their communities directly, or through the application of poultry litter on nearby fields, communities are placed at risk due to environmental exposure. A similar study came out in that reflects Pennsylvania, showing that swine facilities or communities that are in close proximity to swine facilities or fields that were covered with manure from those facilities were at greater risk of contracting staph infections. It's important to mention also that studies on antibiotic resistance after changes in policy show that these interventions work and that reducing antibiotic use on the farm can result in a plateauing or lowering of levels of resistance that threaten public health. One study on the effects of a voluntary withdrawal of ceftiofur from Canadian hatcheries showed that resistance levels lowered both in Salmonella Heidelberg found in chickens and also found Salmonella Heidelberg found in people. Resistance levels then rose after the hatcheries again began injecting their chickens with ceftiofur. Beyond curtailing antibiotic use for disease prevention, data collection under SB 785 would ensure that farmers, policymakers, and the general public would remain informed about progress. At a national level, FDA has no programs to collect and report information about antibiotic use, as opposed to sales, on the farm. Use data would allow the state to track its progress, benchmark use, and direct resources where needed. And the GAO, again, has today called for more information in a report. SB 785 is a necessary step to tackle the antibiotic resistance crisis and help keep our antibiotics effective for everyone. Doctors, nurses, and hospitals cannot do it alone when 70% of the sales of medically important antibiotics are for livestock use. Livestock and poultry producers also need to limit the use of medically important antibiotics on animals that are not sick. These critical life-saving medicines have to be preserved so that we can continue to have them for the use in treating sick animals and sick humans. Thank you for your time.
And just explain again that, because I've been told that the FDA decision that was announced in January took care of this problem, and as I understand it, you're saying it is for the growth hormone only, not for the disease prevention antibiotics.
Yes, it's they took care of the use of antibiotics for growth promotion, but they left this loophole for disease prevention. And it should be pointed out that, you know, GAO literally put out a report today saying that both the FDA and USDA, there are gaps in this whole area. And if you, I quickly read through the report, and it actually does mention that there's problems with preventative uses and certain antibiotics having no duration of use restrictions, which means you can use them for the whole life of the animal. And so they called on the government to take a series of actions, both FDA and USDA and actually CDC. So this should show you that, you know, GAO literally is coming out today and is saying that the FDA action to date has been inadequate and more is needed.
Thank you. Further questions? All right. Thank you very much. Glad to have you here. With that, I'd like to then call up Ron Phillips, Dr. Mark Wustenberg, and Nathan Jackson. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, my name is Ron Phillips. The Animal Health Institute appreciates the opportunity to offer these comments in opposition to 786. AHI is the trade association for research-based manufacturing companies that make animal health products, the medicines that keep our pets and livestock healthy. Antibiotic resistance is an important public health threat. However, we're encouraged that over the past few years, the debate over how to address this important issue has moved beyond the historic finger-pointing about who's causing the problem to a One Health approach that recognizes that all stakeholders in both human and veterinary medicine must work together to ensure that antibiotics are used only when necessary to address health concerns. The CDC report on antibiotic resistance threats that was published in 2013, previously cited, provides important context. That report lists 18 important antibiotic-resistant pathogens that comprise the threat of antibiotic resistance to human medicine, and only two of those 18, the common foodborne pathogens of Campylobacter and Salmonella, said CDC, have potential sources in agriculture. That's why farmers, veterinarians, and those involved in the supply chain work hard to control these pathogens. Federal data from the National Antimicrobial Resistance Monitoring System, or NARMS, shows that progress is being made. The 2014 NARMS report showed that 81% of all salmonella in humans carry no resistance, and that percentage has increased over the 20-year life of the NARMS program. While these trends are encouraging, the ag community is continuing to work to ensure that antibiotics are used only when necessary to fight disease. On January 3rd of this year, FDA announced the full implementation of the Judicious Use Program, which has two parts. First, it eliminates the use of medically important compounds, those classes of antibiotics considered important for use in human medicine, eliminated their use for growth promotion in animals. No longer are these antibiotics used subtherapeutically or to promote growth in animals. Secondly, all remaining uses are brought under the supervision of a licensed veterinarian. All remaining uses, those to treat, control, and prevent disease, are considered by FDA to be therapeutic uses. They're defined as therapeutic because they are targeted. The label lists either a disease, a specific disease, or a specific pathogen against which that drug is targeted, and must, in the judgment of a professional licensed veterinarian, be present before that drug can be administered. As a result of this policy, medically important antibiotics will be used only to fight disease under the supervision of a licensed veterinarian. Two comments more about this policy. One, label indications for prevention of disease are different than the label claims for growth promotion in at least two ways. First, as I mentioned, they are targeted. And second, the dose, the duration, or usually both, are different for growth promotion uses as opposed to prevention uses. Growth promotion uses have been eliminated and cannot continue under a different name. There is no loophole. Secondly, changes cannot simply be rescinded by a new administration. Now that these label changes have been made by the manufacturers, all users must comply with the policy because those labels carry the force of law. Labels for medicated feeds must be adhered to exactly by veterinarians and producers. There is no off-label use. These label changes cannot simply be undone by a new executive order or law, but would require a new approval by FDA based on scientific safety and efficacy data submitted by companies. Finally, I'd like to mention the issue of data collection. The agriculture community is working with FDA and the Department of Agriculture to collect data and information on antibiotic use that will be useful to help producers use antibiotics more efficiently. This program to better understand use is underway at USDA, and all of the major species groups, dairy, cattle, swine, and poultry, are working with university scientists to collect national data for their commodity, which will be turned over to USDA for use in its program. State-level data that is incomplete will not add to our understanding of these use patterns. In addition to providing data, the ag community is working to support additional federal funding for this USDA effort. We oppose this bill because it is unnecessary in light of these current federal changes and efforts. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's have the panel and then ask your question.
My name's Mark Wustenberg. I'm a veterinarian, practiced in private dairy practice for some 30 years, and for the past 12 years have worked in the various executive positions for Tillamook County Creamery Association. A large portion of that time have been responsible for leading the team that does the quality assurance and food safety from cow to consumer. I guess I would just like to reinforce the comments that were just made. I don't think anybody's arguing, if you're in the health profession, whether it's veterinary or medical, that resistance to antibiotics is a serious issue. And it's serious both from a human standpoint in terms of direct use of drugs. It's also serious in terms of our ability to provide a secure food supply. And so I think there's a balance there that we're all trying to strike in terms of making sure that we're all responsible in the way that we're using the tools that we have available. I think what was talked about in the veterinary feed directive is something that is very, I think you need to look at that very carefully and consider the elements that are in there compared to the way it was described in terms of loopholes, because I would tell you from the standpoint of a practicing veterinarian, there are not loopholes in there. The veterinarian is responsible for writing prescriptions, and it's very specific what they can do with them. They can't use off-label. There's limitations in the time that they can actually write those for, and there's limitations actually in the labeling of the drugs in terms of their use so that they can't be used across the entire lifetime of an animal. There's also restrictions in dosages that were mentioned that are differentiated between growth promotion and therapeutic use. And so I personally see the 785 as, well, it's well-intentioned, and I think that, again, we would all agree it's a serious issue and we need to address it. I think it's basically redundant with what we already have in place for regulation through the FDA. I actually see, again, we mentioned some of the activity through FDA. I can tell you personally that Tillamook actually has been approached to see if we can actually find some dairies within our population that would actually participate in these studies. So that is actively going on as far as use, not just in feed and water, but also in individual animal usage within the. So I think the other thing that I would point out is that from a record-keeping standpoint, the record-keeping that's required is actually quite extensive through the FDA, and not only involves the producer, but also involves the veterinarian, and it involves the feed processor or the distributor that actually is making and selling that feed. So if you want to be able to go and track the usage of those antibiotics, FDA has full access to records at multiple levels of how that of the way that system works. And I would maintain that that's probably a system with much higher integrity than one that we would actually put in place in the state. And again, I don't think that the additional collection of records at the state level is going to really provide any additional value to what would be in those records.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. I'm Nathan Jackson, a rancher outside of Myrtle Creek, Oregon, and I live in Senate District 1. I'm also president-elect of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. The Oregon Cattlemen's Association is the voice of the cattle industry in Oregon. We represent over 2,000 ranchers in Oregon, and our aim is to help grow Oregon's beef industry and promote environmentally, socially, and economically sound practices in the production of beef and beef products sold worldwide. Oregon has over 13,000 cattle producers that utilize 57% of state agricultural lands, and the cattle industry comprises 14% of Oregon's total agricultural sector. Our ranchers are men and women committed to producing the highest quality beef, and that, of course, includes strict public health and food safety compliance. SB 785 is an unnecessary burden on Oregon livestock producers. Over the past several years, the Oregon legislature has continued to look at potential legislation that would add a layer of regulation for producers caring for herds and flocks. Bills like SB 785 seek to single out Oregon livestock producers by limiting legitimate and safe use of antibiotics. Unfortunately, while bills like SB 785 add no real protection for consumers and the public, they unfairly regulate Oregon livestock producers and limit the legitimate use of antibiotics as directed by veterinary professionals. These bills, while well-intentioned in their aim to curb antibiotic resistance, are seriously flawed. Bills like SB 785 ignore the realities of federal law and fail to recognize that antibiotic resistance is a real problem that is caused by both the natural evolution of bacteria and many human activities. Our industry has worked hard to do our part to curb unnecessary antibiotic use in food production. In addition, the livestock industry is contributing as scientists and doctors continue to look deeply into patterns of microbial resistance. In fact, the FDA has released data showing Salmonella and Campylobacter prevalence at their lowest levels since the FDA's National Animal Health Monitoring System began collecting data on the use of antibiotics in agriculture. During the past 2 years, since this committee first took up this issue, we have continued our efforts to educate Oregon legislators on evolution of labeling standards by antibiotics manufacturers, the relationship between livestock owners and veterinarians, our commitment to the health of our animals, and most importantly, the health and safety of consumers. SB 785 is just one more attempt to single out the livestock industry in regard to antibiotic resistance without recognizing recent federal law, adding risks of a vague state-regulated program and disregarding the much-needed, safe, preventative nature in which antibiotics are currently used at the direction of a veterinarian. In 2013, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration initiated efforts to promote the judicious use of antibiotics in food-producing animals. The result has been to eliminate the use of antibiotics for growth enhancement and feed efficiency and bring the remaining therapeutic uses, disease treatment, control, and prevention, under veterinary oversight. The FDA judicious use requirement allows a consistent federal standard that applies nationwide. Further, it recognizes that at times antibiotics are necessary and recommended for preventative purposes to protect herd health, avoid epidemics, and limit significant financial loss for producers. SB 785, on the other hand, creates ambiguity for organ producers, limits legitimate use of antibiotics under veterinarian supervision, and drives up our regulatory costs as we try to compete with producers in neighboring states and across the globe. Further, SB 785 and the inaccurate perceptions it perpetuates about our industry does not consider the rigorous food inspection requirements for our products and ensure food does not get to market if livestock have been improperly treated with antibiotics. To be clear to the public and to the legislature, antibiotics are not used to fatten up animals, and any such use is illegal. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you on this important topic. Please recognize our members and our industry's commitment to public health. We ask your support in helping us to educate the public about ag practices and debunking myths. We also ask you to refrain from implementing unnecessary, burdensome regulatory requirements that disadvantage Oregon farming and ranching families amongst our regional and global competitors. We ask you to oppose SB 785. Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, particularly Mr. Phillips, it seems on this issue that there's no disagreement at all that these drugs should not be used for growth. I think that's pretty clear. And it seems like there's agreement that they should be used under proper direction of a veterinarian for therapeutic uses. I guess the question that I'm somewhat confused on is the definition of prevention. When, I know it says it has to be under the direct supervision of a veterinarian, has to be a prescription. I assume that means you can't buy it over the counter without a prescription. And it talks about the time and dose and duration. Can you talk about those and which situations for prevention would a cattleman or a poultry producer use these?
Well, I would tell you as a practicing veterinarian, if you look at the way you need to structure your prescriptions when you write them, you have to identify a specific disease that you are treating. So even if you are looking at doing something across a population of animals for prevention, you have to have some justification, strong justification for saying that there's a specific disease entity that you're targeting and treating within that population. In addition, as was mentioned, you cannot, you do not have the latitude as a veterinarian to prescribe off-label. So there are very specific conditions that the drugs are actually labeled for, and so if you're limited in some cases in this, well, in cases as a veterinarian where you actually see diseases that you would like to go in and prevent, because they're off label, not labeled, you actually are restricted from doing that at this point. So
you'd actually have to have a disease present in the herd that you're trying to prevent from spreading?
Yeah, you would have to. I mean, if the FDA comes in and questions you on your prescription that you wrote, you need to have some sort of tangible justification that you saw a specific disease that you were treating.
So you couldn't just use it to prevent something that might occur. It has to be present?
Nope.
And what he's trying to prevent has to be match what the label says. Because, as I said, the label is going to specify a disease, and that's got to be the disease that he's worried about, or it specifies a specific pathogen, and that's got to be the pathogen that is present as a result of the professional judgment of the veterinarian. So it's not just any kind of prevention. It has to match. It's dictated on the label.
So as an example, if you an antibiotic that would be labeled for respiratory disease, if you saw an issue where you're having a high incidence of something like foot rot in the herd, you're not given the latitude under the Veterinary Feed Directive to prescribe for that specific disease. It has to be the one that's actually that it's labeled for.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Just another comment. You know, the whole issue of preventative, you see something and then you want to make sure that it doesn't spread. I would say anybody who's opposed to that concept should probably not be supporting vaccinating kids.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. All right, with that, Charlie Fisher, George Kimbrell, and Jason Ainsley.
Same thing, Lee. We vaccinate kids.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Charlie Fisher. I'm the state director of the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. We represent tens of thousands of Oregonians around the state. We're a public interest nonprofit. And for the past several years, we've knocked on tens of thousands of doors talking to people about the overuse of antibiotics on farms. And people of all political stripes and all across the state overwhelmingly support reducing the routine use of antibiotics on farms for disease prevention. So I want to share two anecdotes from our members and then talk a little bit more about the disease prevention aspect of this. Elizabeth Langston is one of our members who lives in Eugene. She shared a story of her father who developed MRSA. He luckily survived the illness, but only after having to cycle through multiple antibiotics before finding one that worked. Elizabeth described the experience to me as, quote, beyond scary. Another one of our members in Medford described the experience of his girlfriend with an infected spine. As a result of the infection, she was in the hospital for 10 days, then rehabbed for a month, and had to have something put in her arm to continue administering antibiotics for another 6 weeks. So these are just a tiny sample of some of the real-world consequences of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And if by taking action we could prevent even one person from experiencing a situation like this, it would be worth it. And in this case, the very effectiveness of antibiotics are at stake. So we urge you to support Senate Bill 785. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about the disease prevention and the federal guidelines. First of all, I would reiterate what was said before, that the FDA guidelines do fall very short, and specifically because of that large use of antibiotics for disease prevention. I would point out that the circumstance being described previously is actually allowed under this law. It's disease control. If there is a disease currently on the premises of a farm, the bill allows a farmer to use antibiotics to prevent that disease from spreading to other animals on the farm. What we're talking about is using antibiotics to prevent disease that is not currently on the premises of the farm, which the FDA actually distinguishes between those two uses. So clearly it is something that happens on farms. Beyond that, pharmaceutical companies have, multiple ones, have actually said that they do not believe that the FDA's recommendations will meaningfully reduce sales whatsoever. So you would think that if a rule was intended to reduce the use of antibiotics, you would see subsequent reduction in sales. But the president of the Animal Health Division of Eli Lilly, the fourth largest animal pharmaceutical company in the country, says, quote, "We do not see this announcement being a material event." Another company, Bimeda, said, quote, "Growth uses of medically important antibiotics represent only a small percentage of overall use. So even if all other factors are static, it's unlikely overall use would be greatly affected." I would again point out that, as was stated by Dr. Michael Hansen, about 60% or more of antibiotics are actually used for disease prevention. So it doesn't, it's not too surprising that they wouldn't see too much decrease just removing the growth promotion aspect of antibiotics. The other thing that we have is examples from other countries. Europe, decades ago, put in restrictions on growth promotion for antibiotics, and did not see, and Netherlands, which keeps records of antibiotics consumption, saw that the total antibiotics fed to animals did not decline as a result of the EU restrictions. It was only when Netherlands enacted regulations which actually called for a decline in antibiotic use, and Denmark explicitly outlawed disease prevention as an accepted use for antibiotics, that they saw a reduction in use. So I think both the fact that we don't see any sales decreasing likely, and the data board bears that out, and experience elsewhere shows that the federal guidelines are inadequate. I think the report that came out today backs that up, and we need additional action in Oregon because, again, this is a public health kind of an existential threat to the use of antibiotics, and it's something that we have to take action on. That's why we urge you to support 785 with the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
Chair and panel, I also am from Douglas County. I'm outside of Glide. My name is Jason Ainsley, and I represent Ainsley Farms. We are the largest poultry producer in Douglas County, and I'm also the largest rabbit meat producer in the Northwest. We do not use any antibiotics at all on our farm, and we are pasture-raised poultry, and our sales are skyrocketing. If we have sick animals, we cull them, and we take into account for that, and we have a very small percentage of loss. The USDA has done a study in 2013 and found that organic poultry raisers versus conventional were very similar in the loss that they had. So it's showing that use of antibiotics is not really going to account for profit loss. So as a farmer, that's about all I have to contribute.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate for coming.
Madam Chair, members of the panel, of the committee, George Kimbrell from the Center for Food Safety. We're a nonprofit, nationwide public interest organization, 501c3, kind of work at the intersection of food, agriculture, and the environment. I run our Pacific Northwest office in Portland, Oregon. We've got about 800,000 members across the country and tens of thousands of consumer and farmer members here in Oregon. I also teach food and agriculture law at Lewis and Clark Law School. We strongly support the bill. We helped pass and provided testimony in support of a bill similar in California in 2015. California has been a leader on this issue. We hope Oregon can be as well. We've heard from doctors and every major medical association that you know all the acronyms you can think of on the health side of this, that this is an epidemic, that this is a crisis having to do with antibiotic resistance, that we've got 70% of our antibiotics being used on animals, that we have 2 million Americans, you know, that are infected with antibiotic resistance bacteria every year. So I'm going to skip over that. We shouldn't be feeding our animals. We shouldn't be giving our animals, healthy animals, antibiotics, just like we shouldn't be giving healthy people antibiotics. What I want to talk about is the law. That's what I do. I'm our senior attorney. Like I said, I'm also a professor of law. We've heard from the proponents of animal factories just before us about how the U.S. government has this handled, that there's no need for Oregon to take action here, and that there are rules and regulations and law in place to deal with this. And that's blatantly false and misleading and a mischaracterization of what the Food and Drug Administration has done. So I brought this with me today. Here's what the sum total is of FDA's work on this. It's a guidance document from 2013. This is the same document that was just finalized in January of 2017. They're not different documents, so we're clear on that. It's, and I brought it because it says right at the top that it, quote, contains non-binding recommendations. There it is, guidance 213. Now I'm going to turn to the first page of it. The first page says in bolded letters right there on page 3, quote, FDA's guidance documents, including this guidance, do not establish legally enforceable responsibilities. Instead, the guidances describe FDA's current thinking on a topic and should be viewed only as recommendations unless specific regulatory or statutory requirements are cited. The use of the word should in FDA's guidances means that something is suggested or recommended but not required. Okay? So, what FDA has done here does not have the force of law. It is not a regulation. It is not a rule. It is not a statute. It cannot be enforced in court by a third party, a public interest organization like mine. It can't be enforced by the feds. So, to the extent that it has loopholes, I think that point has already been made. It clearly doesn't cover the use of things like in a preventative way. You're still using antibiotics on healthy animals. But I think my critique is more overarching than that, which is that it is not law at all. And this is what we have from the past administration. To the extent that we have a new administration now, and the cavalry is somehow coming from that administration, if you think that is happening, given what they have said with regards to the public interest and the role of government, then I have some oceanfront property in Idaho that I could sell you. So I don't think we can expect anything more from the current FDA on this. In addition to the health problems, one thing that hasn't been – a couple – more points. What hasn't been talked about today? Number one, the use of antibiotics in this way is a pillar of the industrial agriculture sector, right? So we have a modern industrial agriculture sector that's different than a family farm sector. And this addressing it in this way, passing this law here in Oregon and California and other states, stepping into this regulatory breach and leading the way, is going to help us address these broader problems with the way that we produce food in our country and help us produce healthier food for people and better for the environment. So this is a pillar of that system, the use of antibiotics in this way. It allows them to keep animals in these methods in these giant animal factories. Second, what we're talking about is leveling the playing field for farmers. This is an economic benefit to Oregon farmers as opposed to agribusiness that you've already heard from. So here we're talking about providing a benefit to smaller agriculture, Oregon's method of agriculture, as opposed to agrochemical companies and agribusiness that want to continue this kind of industrialized food production system. And finally, one thing we haven't talked about is the transparency aspect of this bill. There's a very important part of it, the data requirements. We need data. Agriculture is one of those sectors in which we lack sufficient data. We're using old laws for the most part at the federal level, using square pegs and round holes trying to fit. And we have modern problems like this antibiotic resistance problem. This bill would provide some transparency, some data, just like California's does. That's going to help us write better laws and better regulate things for protection of health and the environment, and to protect farmers. People have the right to know how their food is produced. Thank you very much. And I've submitted written testimony that's more lengthy than this, so I'll end there.
That's wonderful. Okay. Thank you. Questions? Okay.
Maybe a comment.
Okay.
I take a lot of issues with a lot of the stuff you said, and you teach this in law school. I find interesting. I almost see in your testimony and ignorance of what really goes on a farm. And as far as your comments about the new administration, I take issue with that. Number one, we don't know what they're going to do. But number two, my hope is that we're going to be having policies based on real science, not political science, which is what you're talking about.
Is there a question?
Nope.
Okay. Can I respond? Or?
No, I think this is fine. All right. Thank you very much. With that, we have about, I would say, 10 minutes, and we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 more people. Oh, five, six more, seven, eight more. So, and we've given the exact amount of time for proponents and opponents, and they've been very equal. So the rest of them are opponents. So I would like you to keep your comments to about 2 minutes so that we can get done on time. With that, it is Dr. Chuck Mayer, Kendall Davis, and Chad Allen.
Chair Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, sorry to jump in here.
Okay.
Members of the committee, the testimony that's been given in opposition to Senate Bill 785 mirrors the position of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, so I'm not going to repeat that in the interest of brevity.
And your name?
Sorry, I'm Dr. Chuck Mayer. So I'm going to answer a couple of questions that have been brought up or attempt to and make comments on them just because it appeared that members of the committee had questions. One of the questions is, and one of the big loopholes of this bill, one of the problems of this bill, is the classification of prevention. I have 35 years in clinical experience. In prevention, we know what the pathogens are that we deal with in particular situations. Antibiotics are used in prevention in human medicine and in veterinary medicine in times of high stress when the immune system is highly suppressed. In human medicine, they're used during times of surgery or other times when patients are under high stress. It pretty routinely, dentists use them. We in veterinary medicine know what pathogens are going to be involved in a particular outbreak of a disease process and due to stresses usually of weather. And so the difference between prevention and treatment is usually 24 hours. If we necropsy animals at the time that we start prevention, we can find the microorganisms that we know we're going to be treating. But if we get behind the eight ball, we lose the whole flock or half the flock. And if we can get those antibiotics in 24 hours sooner, we save everything. Not only do we save everything, but we end up not using antibiotics that are more sensitive, antibiotics that have a higher risk of antibiotic resistance. And so we're able to use antibiotics that have a much lower risk. So that's the first thing I'd like to say about prevention. The second comment that I'd like to make is regards small farms. There's been reference here that small farms are the model that we should be emulating rather than large industry. There is another loophole in this bill, and that is that you can walk into a feed store and buy antibiotics, and you can buy beta-lactams, which are the archetypical antibiotic that is worried about with regard to MRSA, Staph aureus. This has been known for 45 years since I got my degree in microbiology as an undergrad. And small farms routinely, we as veterinarians go out and try to treat animals that have been treated by the small farmers that have bought antibiotics over the counter in the feed store, and we're forced into using more potent antibiotics. And so that's a loophole that isn't talked about in this bill. Other than that, the VFD is law. There's no way around this VFD. If I as a veterinarian want to get antibiotics for prevention and or treatment, and treatment, like I say, and prevention are two sides of the same coin, I'm held to high standards. I have to write a script for those antibiotics to be mixed by the feed company. And I am highly scrutinized, and it is law. So... I would entertain questions. I don't want to take up too much time.
You did 2 minutes and 20 seconds. You did great. All right. Thank you. All right. Please proceed.
Chair Monis Anderson, the committee, thank you so much for letting me testify today about something I am extremely passionate about, livestock. My name is Kendall Davis, and I am a freshman and member of the Saniam Christian FFA. I've been in FFA for 2 years now, and I've showed swine for 3 years, and I'm extremely excited to add another project this year, a dairy heifer. In addition to these that I raise, I show for county and state fair. We have goats and a beef steer on our grass seed farm in Albany. This last January, I was able to help in while my uncle was out of town to deliver the first litter of the year on my own. I've been able to help with all the parts of the pig farm and try to spend all of my free time in the barn, whether it's cleaning pens or working the hogs, getting them ready for fair. I'm here to testify today in opposition in Senate Bill 785. As an up-and-coming pig farmer, to me, it's just common sense. When my animals are sick, I follow labels and treat them according to instructions. I follow withdrawal periods on the label to ensure that there are no residues in the meat. I use medications, depending on the circumstances, to treat my animals and to prevent outbreaks in the entire barn. I read Senate Bill 785, and the reporting part in Section 6 concerns me. It is a big burden on family farms and a small operation such as ours. OSU Extension has put together a resource that we use on our farm explaining VFDs, veterinary feed directives. We currently keep records of all animals, any medicines given, dosages given, and withdrawal periods for each animal. Why does the public need a record of antibiotics administered to my animals? I follow the law and wouldn't use more medicine than I'm supposed to. If I use too much, it wouldn't help my animal. In addition, medicines cost money, and I only use as much as necessary. Committee, I love my animals. I am working hard to learn as much as I can to someday hopefully become a pig farmer myself. All of this information includes my address. Becoming public record doesn't benefit my animal in any way. So I ask myself, why? Why is this necessary? I'm only 14 years old, and even I know that allowing public access and most of that public knowing nothing about farming onto my pig farm does no good. I ask you to join me in opposing Senate Bill 785. Thank you.
It's great to see young women like this getting involved in the political process.
Thank you. All right. Awesome. You did a great job.
Thanks.
Yeah, we definitely got a future leader there. All right. My name is Chad Allen, and I'm here to represent the Oregon Dairy Farmer Association. I'm a dairyman myself in Tillamook. And this particular issue has been going on for years, and we've always had the stance that to really be effective, that this needs to be a federal issue. And we certainly support the veterinary federal directive. It's only been 2.5 months, so I think it's extremely premature to have any understanding of what the impacts this particular new federal rule is going to have in Oregon. And the reporting aspect of this is extremely alerting to me also. We keep track of all antibiotic use on all of our 500 animals, dosage, amount, where it was given, the withdrawal periods, and all this information. We're required to keep it for 3 years. If we ever have an issue and FDA shows up on our doorstep and we don't have this type of information, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. We've spent months developing a antibiotic use directive with our personal veterinarian that goes over all the different types of diseases, the antibiotics in which we can use to treat those diseases, the doses based on the weight, the withdrawal periods. All of this data is also shared with training sessions with all our employees. It's a big deal. But this information is my information. It doesn't serve the public any good for me to hand that over and to bring them a spotlight into my business. That's a relationship between any dairyman or any food producing animal and their veterinarian. And it's really a violation of our privacy in regards to that. As animal food producers, we take this stuff very, very serious. We don't waste antibiotic use. For those that are involved in animal production, antibiotics are very expensive. There's some that are lesser than others, but you just don't blink a treat. You just can't afford to. Margins continue to decrease and profits shrink. And running a great vaccine program with the guidance of your vet is really the best prevention that we've found. And so agriculture has no borders.
Thank you.
Milk is a commodity. Beef is a commodity and is traded in the whole world. And so for Oregon to segregate themselves and create rules that are different than their neighboring states is just bad policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all of you and your testimony. With that, Ralph Rohde, Charles Mayer, and Larry and Sophie Bushman.
Madam Chair, Larry and Sophie Bushman yield their time.
Okay, thank you very much. Please proceed.
So do I get the full 15 minutes?
No, because we still have some after you. Okay. And
I'm Ralph Rodia, and I represent the Oregon State Beekeepers Association. And you might wonder why a beekeeper's up here. And it's because the way this law is written, because under federal law, under livestock, bees are defined as livestock, which means that this bill could apply to beekeepers, whether you're a commercial, a backyard beekeeper, or a sideline beekeeper. And right now, under the federal law, we only actually use two antibiotics. And neither one of those can we buy anymore. We have to go to a vet who says, what do you want a prescription for? Vets don't know anything about bees. So we have a difficult time enough with the feds right now trying to comply, to let alone have this come on top of it and have potentially Oregon Department of Ag classify honeybees as livestock, okay? And so we think unless something, we can't support the bill or its amendment as written.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Well, it looks like then we have everybody. I don't think we've missed anyone, correct, that wanted to speak on Senate Bill 785? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just maybe a closing comment. Most people know I am a farmer, so I know a little bit about agriculture, been involved for 60 years. It isn't mom-pa kettle anymore. Agriculture is an incredibly scientific and an incredibly precise industry anymore. Everything is taken into consideration. And one of the last testifiers did point out something very important, and that's the economics of it. In my farm, I don't use anything I don't have to because I can't afford to do that. The margins aren't great enough. And especially if we're talking about the cattle industry at this point in time, it would be nice to see the market come back, but it really hasn't yet. So people are running on thin margins. They aren't going to do anything they don't have to. So let's keep in mind that this is a scientific industry, and they do know what they're doing.
Thank you, everyone who's come to talk about this bill. I'll be talking with the proponents to see where they want to go now that we've had a public hearing. We'll definitely be talking with the opponent, government relations people. So with that, I would like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 785 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 744. Rico Dents.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 44. 744 is in front of you. It provides the Oregon Health Authority with rulemaking authority to develop and disseminate information to providers and patients, educating them about bone marrow donations and how to register with the National Bone Marrow Registry.
Well, thank you, Senator, for introducing the bill. I appreciate that Oregon is the very first state to introduce this bill. I've been traveling the U.S. and advocating.
You need to say your name first.
Oh, my name is Rico Dents, and I'm started an organization called the Great Ribbon Rally, and I'm advocating for young adults dealing with cancer. I live with chronic myeloid leukemia, and actually I drove in from Connecticut with $75 to my name and a tank of gas, and I came out here because how important this is. Because the Bone Marrow Registry basically helps people to save lives. We're giving people hope. Less than 2% of Americans are registered bone marrow donors. Yesterday I was over at Oregon State University, and there was about 100 students, and it took about 4 hours to get 100 registered bone marrow donors. It takes time. Versus having a doctor talk about the bone marrow registry with people who from 18 to 44. What I do recommend is within the legislation to add the question on the questionnaire for the patient intake form, so it saves time with the doctor. It makes it more efficient, so the doctor's not always thinking about the bone marrow registry because they need to make sure they're taking care of the patient as well. But there's some new advancements on technology from cerebral palsy, nerve and restoring the nerve for peripheral blood stem cell transplant. So there's a lot of stuff in the future. We don't know how much this bone marrow registry will help save additional lives beyond that. Every 9 minutes, someone dies in the U.S. from a blood cancer, and less than 50% ever find the match that they need. and 70% of all the matches come from non-family members. And do you guys know the difference of the two types of how to receive bone marrow? Okay, a lot of people, it's been since 1986, the peripheral blood stem cell transplant happens. A lot of people still think about having to get the transplant from the hip bone, and that fearful from it from back in the 70s, because we hear about the fear, not hearing about the ease of the current 80% of all transplants happen. And basically, it's like as simple as giving plasma now these days. So it's a lot easier.
So how do you get the match? It doesn't come from the bone.
Now, basically, what they inject a drug in you called filgrastim. It increases your blood DNA, and then they extract it 3 to 5% of it through your vein and using a dialysis machine, and then putting it back in the blood through the other way, the other vein. So it's a very simple procedure. It takes a couple hours for someone, and it really gives a person the opportunity to live. I've known two people who did not get the transplant that they needed to pass away. I don't need a transplant. I have a different type of leukemia, but less than 50% of the people ever find a match that they need.
Yes, a
couple questions, kind of off subject just a little bit. I mean, I had a bone graft in my wrist where they took marrow out of my hip. This was a long time ago, obviously. But I was also on the registry. Why do you age off of the bone marrow registry?
Basically, the DNA isn't good. I don't know the full answer of that.
Okay.
But
okay.
I think basically between 44 and older, they want healthier patients, per se, even though someone who's older, I know the terminology,
okay.
And I'm not, I mean, I can't donate because I have leukemia. I mean, there's...
Well, and I mean, I signed up long, long time ago, obviously, because I had a friend with leukemia, and I thought maybe you never know, but then I find out that I'm too old, and I know I'm too old for a lot of things, but it didn't quite make sense to me as how you could age out of something like that, because my bones are still working and producing stuff. So, anyway,
I haven't found this. I could ask about that scientific information and get back to you.
Okay, we don't have any. Do you have any other questions for him? Okay.
I just do encourage you guys to really look at the bill. I didn't have chances to get the testimony from
other
people.
That's okay. This is a great introduction. Sometimes it takes two or three sessions for us to get something through the legislature. So this is a really good first step. Also, I would like you to know that once I hear that you drove out from Connecticut, next time, let's Skype or do telecommunication. I'm sure we have contacts with some people back in Connecticut that could do that.
Well, I was thinking, too, because I've had some flack from people about what I'm doing, and I wanted to get the video of actually showing that I've been testifying and doing what I'm saying.
That's right.
So this is the first state to show proof.
And quite honestly, whether we can go there this time or not, Madam Chair, the fact is encouraging people to get on any donor registry, I think, is a very worthwhile effort.
Definitely. Because
I'm on every damn one I can find. So.
Okay.
And it's very simple, and I think the key is it's a lot of people just don't know the information how to get registered.
Right.
And the doctor is the easiest one, because they're a medical professional, to ease any potential fear or questions that someone has. It's not the same thing as the DMV. I've talked to many people thinking that you get registered at the DMV versus being registered of the donor, you know, on your card if you're a donor. That's once you pass away. People don't even know that you could donate bone marrow when you're alive.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not death. And so there's a lot of misinformation out there. And because I think it's still the cheapest way to get the information through the doctor, doesn't cost anything to the doctor, doesn't cost anything to the patient, doesn't cost anything to the state. And it's a win-win-win bill. So you help to save lives.
And hopefully you'll be able to access this hearing video.
Yeah.
Yes, you know how to do that. Okay. Now, stay right there, but I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 744 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 859.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 859, the measure would require licensed physicians that practice oncology in Oregon to discuss fertility risks with adolescent oncology patients. Requires the Oregon Medical Board to adopt rules and implement provisions of the bill. There is a dash one post on OLIS, no impact statements.
Well, thank you. My name is Rico Dents. Do I repeat? Okay, my name is Rico Dents, and I started the Great Ribbon Rally, and I've been to 20 states in the last, since June, and I've met with a lot of young adults dealing with cancer, and a lot of them have talked to me. Probably 95% of them said that the doctor didn't talk to them, the oncologist talked to them about fertility prior to cancer treatment. And this is an important issue. According to Stupid Cancer, 13%, only 13% of oncologists do talk about fertility options. I've also seen the National Coalition of Cancer, NCCN, and they have basically the top 20 hospitals in the U.S., and they do talk about the importance of fertility and discussion on it. But another statistics, less than 50% of educational facilities ever talk about fertility options. And non-educational hospitals, it's less than 10%. So, I mean, there's a lot of questions across the board on what it is. But the problem is that once you're diagnosed with cancer and you get some chemotherapy, it could cause you to become infertile. Women never grow new eggs. They get the eggs in the ovaries right away. And then adult males, you know, that's a whole different thing. But preserving fertility is a very important issue. And why that's important is we've gotten now people who are surviving longer don't necessarily think about once you're diagnosed with cancer, you're not thinking about fertility. You're thinking about, am I going to live? What do I need to do to live? And you're now learning either chemotherapy or other regimens that are going on. And I was over at Yale Hospital in February, and I was at the Young Adults Milo. It's called Impact Group. There were six of us. There's six other people, and I was the only guy there. And we were just talking about this issue. And in Yale, which is one of the top hospitals in the world, all of them didn't feel like they were adequately discussed fertility options prior to their treatment. And they learned stuff afterwards. I was down in Houston with a friend of mine. I met him and talking. He had stomach cancer. And just that day prior to cancer, his oncology treatment, he asked the nurse, is this going to cause me to become infertile? And he was like, the nurse was like, yeah, no one talked to you about it. So this is an issue because being able to have a kid in your arm is the most important thing. I mean, after being diagnosed with cancer, and dealing with that and dealing with those emotions, then being told now you can't have kids because you were not discussed fertility options and you not preserved your fertility. And I've heard stories and upon stories of people who I've talked to about that. And it's just sad because I was living with cancer and I couldn't imagine because I could have kids in the future, but I couldn't imagine after just dealing what you've had to deal with the financial challenges, deal with the emotional challenges of friends and other issues, and then finding out, you finally find a spouse or a husband, and you got to tell them that I can't have kids. That's a tough situation. So let's help prevent the double whammy.
So you're saying that, I mean, it is possible then to freeze your sperm or freeze the eggs ahead of time, and you're saying that this is not a routine practice among physicians.
Yes, and even in the non-educational facilities, even with testicular cancer patients, 10% of the doctors talk about preserving fertility.
Well, the representative from the Cancer Society is in the back room, and I'm sure he's taking notes to share that, to see what kind of education that we can disseminate. Stay there, but we need Trevor Belts to come up from the Oregon Medical Association.
Good Good afternoon, Chair Montes Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Trevor Belts. I'm the Associate Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Medical Association. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 859 today, which would require oncologists to discuss fertility and adolescent patients. To discuss fertility with adolescent patients before they undergo necessary chemotherapy, radiation, and other treatment that could pose risk to a patient's fertility. The OMA and its members understand firsthand how difficult it is for a patient and family to go through diagnosis and treatment for any type of cancer. Circumstances of an adolescent with cancer are very emotional for all involved and rightfully made more difficult given the fact that treatment may negatively impact a patient's fertility. With that, however, the OMA has some serious concerns with the bill before you today, concerns shared by our partners at OHSU, and I'd like to outline several points that I've discussed with OMA's oncologist members on the issue. It's our understanding that the standards of practice already exist to discuss fertility issues with new adolescent patient cancer patients. I cannot speak to other states. I cannot speak to the number of the prevalence of that, but the oncologists that we were able to speak with thought that this was a standard of practice, at least in Oregon. It is important to understand that there are many components to this discussion. For example, especially in adolescent cases, time is the enemy, and many diagnoses require urgency in the treatment plan. The other component of this very sensitive and difficult issue that is not addressed in this bill and provides even more of an issue for these young patients is the cost to preserve fertility options like sperm or egg preservation. These procedures are often out of the question financially for the patients and their families and are rarely covered by insurance plans. So in conclusion, we think this legislation, although brought forward with very good intentions, is an unneeded bill, and we do not believe that having prescriptive language in how physicians treat their patients should be placed in statute. Thank you.
I would hope, though, that if someone is diagnosed, I mean, sure, it's one thing when they're diagnosed when they're 2 or 3 years old. But if they are adolescents, I would hope that every physician would discuss this with the patient. And I don't know if that's standard practice or not.
It's not.
So I would hope that you would share this hearing with your members and, well, with the oncologists in particular, to see if there could be some kind of standard of care for adolescents. I haven't worked much with cancer patients, so I can't relate to the situation, but I know if I was diagnosed, I certainly would. You know, when you're diagnosed, you're going to beat this. You're going to fight it, and you want to go on and live a normal life, and I would hope that that opportunity would be given to that patient, if in particular that they would want to have a family in the future.
Yeah, Senator Cruz.
I'm wondering why it would be limited to teenagers and not include young adults.
Section 2 actually addresses that part, Section 2, which is oncology, a young adult. So it is actually cancer patients on Section 2. We were talking about that yesterday.
Yeah. That would be the a parental decision also when they're that young.
I apologize for coming late. I was actually out being a doctor. So obviously, I think it's super important to make sure that people understand about long-term options for fertility at every age, regardless. I mean, we deal with this obviously with people with other chronic illnesses. We need to talk with them about fertility issues and safe plans for the future. But I guess the concern I have is that I worry when the state gets in the business of mandating what goes on between doctors and patients. And in general, we try really hard to stay out of the exam room. And as a physician, I'm glad of that. Can you think of some alternative ways we could approach this that would accomplish the goal of substantially increasing, not mandating, but substantially increasing the likelihood that this problem would be addressed without putting it in statute?
Yeah, no, good question. The problem is that I've thought about it, and I thought either prior to treatment, even having the social worker talk to him about it, or having another person, because I've talked to social workers across the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and they say that the doctors are not adequately giving the fertility discussion. There is a lot of stuff that happens also at the moment when one, I don't know if you've ever diagnosed someone with the cancer.
I have.
So
I don't like it.
It's not an easy discussion. So, and that's why it's important to have, like, with the sign off and saying, hey, this is something to consider off on your fertility. What he didn't mention too, there was two things. He didn't give any statistics on how often the doctors were talked about fertility options. Second, federal mandate actually requires insurance to cover some of the fertility stuff.
Sure.
But there is a two-step process. You have to get denied from the insurance and go to the board, the health board in Oregon, and that's across every single state. And this is some of the stuff that we're working on, getting more knowledge. Alice, I can't think of from the organization who testified in writing about this particular issue as well. She told me, because she called me and told me these are the different issues and how to address even the cost of fertility and preservation. A lot of people don't know about it, and mm-hmm. it's just taking time to learn.
Yeah.
And even timing. I understand the timing. There are certain cases, and he's right. Certain leukemias, if you don't get, and certain other cancers, if you're not treated right then and there,
right.
you're going to die. So there's not the ability to have preservation. And I know we have to work on allowing the health board to make some rules and regulations on that. And allow the doctor to make the decision, hey, in my opinion, there's no way we could do fertility because it takes 3 weeks, or I think it's 4 weeks for women. Men, it's a lot easier timing to do stuff.
So, Madam Chair, if I may, I am entirely sympathetic to what you're trying to accomplish here, and I absolutely want to make sure that our younger cancer survivors have every opportunity to live a normal life, including becoming biological parents, should they so choose. As I said, I would love to be able to have you guys be thinking creatively about ways to work closely with the oncology community. I mean, for example, I know that Dr. Drucker, who's the head of the Knight Cancer Institute, is very interested in making sure that we deal really well with cancers in younger people and young adults, and I know that he's looking at ways of taking a much more holistic approach to it. So is there an opportunity for you to work with the Knight Cancer Institute? Is there an opportunity with Cancer Center at Providence and some of the other bigger cancer centers statewide? Most younger people are being treated either at Legacy or at Dornbecker because they have the pediatric expertise that a lot of other places don't have. So really sympathetic, and I just don't know what other steps you've tried so far to work with the oncology community directly about this issue, besides talking to social workers.
Senator Hayward, as working with oncology, there's a lot of red tape and time and effort to go through on that side. Second, what we don't always think about, might be thinking about who's one doctor, but majority of the time, like even the older oncology, like not in educational facilities, because non-educational facilities talking about fertility is very low. It's less than 13%. And so within that, the problem is when a doctor doesn't typically have a young adult about colon cancer or other cancers, they're not thinking about fertility. And that's part of the issue, is because they've not thought about the fertility in the non-educational facilities, and even at educational facilities. And it is making importance of saying, hey, we need to talk about this. And how much effort we're trying to go to every single hospital to go and do this, because that's really, at the end of the day, it has to make every single hospital to talk about it. And within that time frame, there's young adults who are not being able to preserve fertility options.
I would like to read into the record Alice Christie's. She's a 9-year breast cancer survivor, and she was able to fulfill her dream of having a child because she, and this is in her statement, I discussed fertility risk with my oncologist prior to receiving cancer treatment and then was referred to an oncofertility specialist in time to do something about it. So she also went on to say that there really are few patients are afforded this opportunity because cancer centers have really failed to implement an informed consent procedure mm-hmm. that ensures the fertility risk conversation. A recent article published in Cancer quoted a study in which only 13% of reproductive age breast cancer patients were informed of their that their fertility would be at risk from the life-saving cancer treatment. And so, you know, I think this is the start of a really very important conversation, and I so thank you for bringing it forward. Any other questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. It was a delight to meet you, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 859, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 964.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is Senate Bill 964, brought to you by the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. The measure would allow hospitals in Oregon to grant privileges to physician assistants to provide patient care. There are no fiscal revenue statements, no amendments.
Great. Aaron Kramer, Elizabeth Remley, and Andy Easton.
Thank you, Chair Bonas and the other members of the committee. My name is Aaron Kramer. I'm a physician assistant. I work at the Sublimity Medical Clinic and work for for Saniam Hospital in Staten. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 964. Urge your support as well. This bill is a simple bill. It explicitly allows hospitals to credential PAs for admitting privileges. It doesn't require hospitals to do so, and this is an already common practice statewide. It has implicit allowance via several sections or one particular sections of the OAR, but in a recent opinion issued by some auditors from CMS, this caused disruption at one large hospital in Central Oregon. Because OAR 333-510-0010 only names doctors and nurse practitioners, that hospital has chosen to pull back from their practice of allowing physician assistants to admit patients. It's changed their practice. It's taken a step backward. It's harmed patient care in that regard. It's not a CMS rule that PAs can't do this. CMS does allow PAs and nurse practitioners to admit patients with co-signature. So it's really a matter of the Oregon administrative rules that is preventing this from happening. This bill will clarify the issue now and in the future by explicitly listing them. The hospital in question plans to resume their past practice as soon as they feel that this is safe for them to do or legitimate for them to do. Meanwhile, other hospitals are continuing to do it already. This prevents repeating this mistake, and so again, I urge that you support that. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. The bill is as simple as Aaron says it is. We've spoken with both the health authority, the hospital association, and several other stakeholders. We think that this is a relatively straightforward clarification in statute. We will be working with the hospital association on one small technical amendment to make sure that we get this exactly right the first time. And so we hope to have that amendment ready to go so that you can vote on the bill soon. Thank you.
Great.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton here on behalf of Oregon 62 Hospitals. And we do appreciate the Physician Assistant Association bringing forward this bill because it does add clarity that we need for some of our hospitals. There is one section that we are a little bit concerned around, and we do appreciate the PAs working with us to clarify that. It is Section 1, Subsection 4. And it talks about, and it ties a PA who is currently a dependent practitioner who is under the supervision of a physician. It ties them to nurse practitioners who are an independent practitioner and gives them the same rights and repeal process, due process, as a independent practitioner. That is concerning for a few of our hospitals whose medical bylaws have separated PAs from the independent practitioners in their processes, and so we appreciate that the PAs are willing to work with us to solve that concern, and we look forward to coming back with you with a bill that has both of our strong support on.
Great. And will you then work with Oliver to have that amendment drafted and just CC me when you have the language? Any other questions here?
I just, Mr. Chair, just, she says it's straightforward, but obviously nothing in this building is truly straightforward.
Madam Chair, good bill should pass.
Yes, absolutely.
No, it's a good bill. I just.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. Thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 964, and Oliver, as soon as we have the amendment, we can schedule it for work session. With that, I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 743.
D21,
yeah.
Okay.
It's the dash.
Madam Chair, I move we adopt the dash three amendments dated 3-6-17.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the dash three amendments dated 3-6-17. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Mark, Senator Canope is excused. Motion is adopted.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 743 as amended by the DAS 3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 743 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Yes.
Excused.
Senator Steiner-Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair
Montesano? Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Steiner-Hayward will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 743.
Why not?
Okay, with that, we are adjourned.
Oh, boy.
Well, you were talking about carrying bills earlier today. So
I was?
You were talking about carrying bills earlier today. So
I was?
Oh, boy.